This time, I'd like to call upon our brother Jim and deliver to us his class, which he has entitled Significant Prophetic Events in the Financial World, Britain, Europe, and the Papacy. Brother Jim.
Well, thank you, Brother Michael, and good evening, brethren and sisters, and young people and friends. As you can see from the title, we're going to try and cover a little bit of ground tonight, ground that we believe is very important in relation to fulfilling Bible prophecy. But it's going to start quite unusually. You're going to get a surprise for the first 10 minutes of this session tonight, because I'm not going to talk very much. I'm going to let someone else do the talking for me, which is a bit of a change, isn't it? But you'll see why in a minute. The signs are so numerous that people now are amazed at the number of things that are happening in our world. Senior politicians in this country are saying they've never seen a time when so many things are happening together. Well, there has to be reasons for that. We believe there are reasons for that. We believe, of course, the angels are very, very active at the moment. They always are, but they're very active at the moment, bringing to pass the things that are required to introduce our Lord Jesus Christ back to the earth to raise the dead. So the signs are very numerous. But here is one that is unmistakable. That's why I want to start with it tonight. 70 years of almost unbroken prosperity in our world, in much of the world. I know there's poverty in Africa and other places, but even they've got McDonald's on every corner. You know, the world is generally very prosperous. We've never experienced this in human history that I can remember. Last 70 years, well, it's about to come to an end, because you're going to see the reason it's going to come to an end in a moment. And men's hearts will then truly fail for fear of things that are coming on the earth, because I believe this is going to introduce that time described in Daniel chapter 12, our reading for yesterday, a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation on the earth. So I'm going to stop talking and let you listen to this.
My name is Steve Myers, and I want to thank you for taking part in this exclusive Monday morning interview with Jim Rickards, the financial threat and asymmetric warfare advisor for both the Pentagon and CIA. Recently, all 16 branches of our intelligence community have come together to release a shocking briefing that contained an alarming consensus. These agencies, that include the CIA, FBI, Army, and Navy, they've already begun to estimate the impact of the fall of the dollar as the global reserve currency, and our reign as the world's leading superpower being annihilated in a way equivalent to the end of the British Empire post-World War II. And the endgame could be a nightmarish scenario, where the world falls into an extended period of global anarchy. Jim Rickards fears he and his colleagues' warnings are being ignored by our political leaders and the Federal Reserve, and we're on the verge of entering the darkest economic period in our nation's history, one that will ignite a 25-year Great Depression. Today, we're going to examine everything he's uncovered, because a bedlam could begin within the next 6 months, which is why every American should hear his warnings before it's too late. Barber.
There's now concern in different branches of the U.S. government. Historically in Washington, the Treasury and the Fed take care of the dollar. The Pentagon, the intelligence community take care of other threats. But what happens when the dollar is the threat? Americans generally know that the Fed has increased the money supply by $3.1 trillion. We have $17.5 trillion of debt. We have $127 trillion of unfunded liabilities. What are those? Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, student loans, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA. You go through the whole list, and it goes on and on and on. There's no way to pay. Because 50 million Americans are on food stamps. It's not that we don't have distress. We have enormous distress, but it's being hidden in different ways. The unemployment rate today is actually 23% when you calculate it the right way. But compare this decline of velocity today to what we saw leading up to the Great Depression. Now, in the depths of the Great Depression, velocity was even lower. But if you compare what's going on today to what happened in the late 1920s, just prior to the Great Depression, there's a very striking resemblance. So it doesn't matter how much money the Fed prints. The Fed is trying desperately to bend the curve. Think of it as an airplane that's coming in for a nosedive. It's crashing, crashing, getting closer to the ground. The Fed's trying to grab the joystick and pull the plane up out of the nosedive and get it back in the air. But unfortunately, it's not working. We're heading for a crash. The Federal Reserve actually in some ways already has failed. I spoke to a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, and I said, you know, I think the Fed's insolvent on a mark-to-market basis. And this governor first resisted and said, no, we're not. But I pressed her a little bit harder, and she said, well, maybe. And then I just looked at her, and she said, well, we are, but it doesn't matter. In other words, here's a governor of the Federal Reserve admitting to me privately that the Federal Reserve is insolvent, but said, you know, it doesn't matter because central banks don't need capital. Well, I'm going to suggest that central banks do need capital. Look at this chart. What it shows you is that the Fed has increased its capital. It's currently about $56 billion. That sounds good. You say, gee, $56 billion is a lot of money. That's a pretty good capital base. But that's not the whole story. You have to compare the capital to the balance sheet. How much in the way of assets and liabilities is that amount of capital supporting? When you look at that, it's a much scarier picture because the actual liabilities, or debt, if you will, in the Fed's books are $4.3 trillion. So you've got $4.3 trillion sitting on this little skinny capital base of $56 billion. That's very unstable. Prior to 2008, the leverage was about 22 to 1, meaning they had $22 of debt on their books for every $1 of capital. Today, that leverage is 77 to 1. So yes, the capital has increased, but the debt and the liabilities have increased much more. The problem is not limited to the Fed. It's infecting the private banking system as well. There's about $60 trillion of debt on the balance sheets of our banking system. For a long time, debt in the banks grew at about 2 times the rate of growth in the economy. But lately, this has exploded. Today, it's up to 30 to 1. In other words, for every dollar of economic growth, there's $30 of credit being created by the banking system. The whole thing's unstable. One of the key flashpoints we're looking at is foreign ownership of U.S. government debt. Now, this is a very important thing to understand. We all know that the Treasury has issued over $17 trillion worth of debt. The question is, who buys it? A lot of U.S. debt is owned by foreigners. Who owns it? China, Russia, other countries, countries that are not necessarily our friends, but they can dump it when they want to. Well, guess what? That's actually what's been going on. Recently, foreign holdings of U.S. government debt have been plummeting. But it gets even more interesting than that. We talked earlier about the project I did for the CIA, Project Prophecy, and we said you can see not only market action, but rivals, enemies, terrorists, and others operating in financial markets. So we all know that Russia invaded Crimea in the spring of 2014, and Crimea is now effectively part of Russia. So let's say you're Putin. You know you're going to invade Crimea. You know you want to take over eastern Ukraine. You can expect U.S. financial sanctions. So what do? You basically mitigate the impact of the sanctions. Start dumping treasuries in advance so that when you make your move and the treasury tries to come against you, you've insulated yourself. So now you go back and look at October. Here's Russia dumping treasuries month after month. That was a clear signal that they were getting ready to do something to engage in financial warfare against the United States. Guess what? It's worse than that. We know the Russians and Chinese are working together. So is it any surprise that when the Russians started dumping, the Chinese started dumping also? The foreigners are now dumping treasuries. And if no one buys, guess what? Interest rates go up. That'll sink the stock market. That'll sink the housing market. Higher interest rates mean the debt gets higher. So interest rates go up some more. So you start a death spiral and there's no way out of it.
An attack on our treasury market is obviously a very serious flashpoint that could ignite this great depression you predict in your book. Let's talk about another flashpoint.
What I call flashpoint number two has to do with the petrodollar.
Can you explain what you mean by the petrodollar?
It's basically a system whereby oil exports are priced in dollars. The first leg of the stool has been pulled out. The Saudis are going to back away from the petrodollar because we're no longer guaranteeing their security because we're playing footsie with Iran. Second leg of the stool is Russia. Now, Russia is not a member of OPEC, but they are the world's largest oil exporter, one of the world's largest energy exporters, actually bigger than Saudi Arabia. So even though they're not a member of OPEC, they also price oil in dollars. So they've signed on to the petrodollar deal in their own way. But we're now engaged in financial warfare. Russia's ready to fight back. And this is not, you know, classified information. This is being said publicly. Andrei Kostin, president and chairman of Russian Vinnytsiyor Bank, VTB Bank, it's one of the largest banks in Russia, he recently said, it's time to change the entire international financial system that considers the dollar the key reserve currency. The world has changed. There was another member of the Russian parliament. He said, the dollar is evil. We will sell rubles to consumers of our oil and gas, and later we'll exchange the rubles for gold. If they don't like this, let them not do it. Let them freeze to death. So two of the legs of the stool, Saudi Arabia and Russia, have already been pulled out. The third leg is China, and that leg is coming out too.
Jim, in your book, you investigate how nations are now using gold as a financial weapon. Is this one of the most dangerous flashpoints?
It's absolutely one of the most dangerous flashpoints, and here's why. A lot of people look at the dollar and say, look, you may not like the dollar, you may worry about the dollar, but you've got nowhere else to go. But there is another place to go, which is gold. You don't have to buy treasuries, you can buy gold. And countries are actually doing that. So this is basically a global rebalancing of gold reserves. This is one of the things that the intelligence community is watching most closely, and China's our number one case. Here's why. China has acquired more than 3,000 tons in the past 4 years. Now they lie about this. They officially say they have 1,054 tons. The reason is China is using their own military and their own intelligence assets to acquire some of this gold in stealth. Now, why is China doing this? A lot of people speculate that they want to launch their own gold-backed reserve currency. So take the Chinese yuan, back it with gold, make it a global reserve currency. That's extremely unlikely. That's not what China's doing. What they are trying to do is hedge against the collapse of the dollar. China can't prevent that from happening. What they can do is build up the gold reserves. This is known to the intelligence communities. This is not publicly revealed. What if it were publicly revealed? Here's what global gold reserves would look like if the amount that China owns were actually suddenly revealed. This is a dagger aimed at the heart of the dollar.
So why is all that significant? That's the question I ask when you see what's happening. And that's just, of course, a selection of a 45-minute program in which all of that was laid out. And it's been corroborated. I've been receiving information from brethren who work inside ratings agencies. They know that this information is true. The world is on the verge of a huge economic depression. It's coming. When it will come, we don't know. But what we do know is this, that when it does come, we will have been taken to the judgment seat. And that's why we read tonight from Luke chapter 17. I want to just draw your attention to Luke 17 without going into all the details, because there are other things that we want to consider. In Luke chapter 17, the Lord Jesus Christ made it very, very plain that when he comes, he will come to take his servants from times of general prosperity. That's why he chooses the days of Noah and the days of Lot. He could have chosen other eras of divine judgment. He doesn't. When he does choose these two eras, he doesn't make any mention of the problems that existed in that day. What were the problems in the days of Noah? Well, violence, yes. What was the problem in the days of Lot? Immorality of the worst kind, perhaps? Yes. No mention of that by Christ. He's not interested in that. That's not to say it wasn't going to happen. It is happening. Violence and immorality. But he wasn't interested in that. He was interested in one aspect of those days, and that was prosperity. Remember Lot's wife, he says. He that is on the housetop, let him not come down to take his stuff out of the house. His fear was that the greatest test of his servants at the end of the days would be that general prosperity. So you see, that's why the Lord Jesus Christ points out what was happening in the days of Noah and Lot. They were eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage and buying and selling and planting and building. Yes, all of those things. A culture of pleasure and prosperity. Well, all their prosperity in the days of Noah and the days of Lot came to an end virtually in a day. When Noah was locked away with his family in the ark, which is equivalent to us being taken to the judgment seat of Christ, if we're responsible. Yep. When Lot was taken with his family out of Sodom, that day it all went down the gurgler. You know, those who went down in Sodom on that morning to get their latte at the local coffee shop never got to finish it. Their whole economy collapsed, didn't it? Very violently in their case. That's exactly what's going to happen again, brothers and sisters. That's why the Lord Jesus Christ draws on that. He's giving us very real clues as to what we can expect. Just like when the angels turned up at the house of Lot to collect him and his family, so they will come to our house in the evening. I normally would point out that the Lord uses the term day 10 times here, 5 in the singular, 5 in the plural, from verse 20 onwards to the end of this chapter. But then he changes it. Look at verse 34. I tell you in that night, There shall be two in one bed. Doesn't mean two men. Two in one bed. He means a husband and wife. He's just been talking about Lot's wife. He's talking about people like Lot and his wife. Both of them responsible, both going to judgment. And that's why, of course, goes on to say this. The one should be taken and the other left. It's not about being removed and the other not being removed. It's not what those words mean. The word taken is paralambano. It means to be taken into a marriage. Lot will go to the marriage. The word left is the Greek word aphiemi. It's used in the New Testament about being put out of a marriage. Lot's wife will be put out of the marriage. They'll both go to the judgment seat. One will go to the right hand and the other will go to the left. You see what he's saying here? He will send the angels. It will be the evening. You know, they'll probably come to Australia first, the angels, after they've dealt with the resurrected dead, remove them to the judgment seat, because you see, we're 14 or 15 hours in front of you and you can't expect a phone call from me. My feet will be standing in front of Mount Horeb, so you won't get a phone call from me. All right, that's what you can expect. And it will come before the crash. And the next morning, your neighbours won't care where you are. Your boss will not care where you are. You know where he's going to be or she's going to be? Lined up at the banks trying to get their money out. And there'll be vacant houses and cars left all over the place. Not going to be concerned about where Christadelphians have gone. They'll be too concerned about survival. So you see, that's the scenario that's painted here by our Lord Jesus Christ. That's why it's so important to know where we sit in the scheme of things. To know. The world knows it's coming, brothers and sisters. They know it's coming. They can't tell you exactly when, but I will remind you that Black Thursday in 1929, when the stock market collapsed in Wall Street, triggering the 1930 worldwide depression, Black Thursday happened on the 18th of November. It's the 4th of November today. So it can happen in November. All right? Collapses always come in October and November. So it might happen this year. The world thinks it's close, so we'll have to wait and see. One thing, though, we need to take the warning for what it is. Now, if you want final proof that Christ couldn't have been clearer about this matter of collecting us for the judgment seat out of times of prosperity, it can come from Luke 21, verses 34 to 36, from Matthew 24, which is the same message as Luke 17. It can come from Revelation chapter 3. Because you see, there are seven letters to the ecclesias, and the last of those letters, and these letters we know, were actually prophecies. They were written to the ecclesias of Asia Minor, but they were actually prophecies from the time of John down to the return of Christ. This is the seventh and last. It's the only one that has certain words in it. We are the Laodicean generation in ecclesial history. The time is a time of unparalleled prosperity. So what was the problem of Laodicea? Well, because thou sayest, I am rich and increase with goods and have need of nothing. Yeah, rich and increase with goods. This is the only letter that has these words in it. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. It's the only one. What's it tell you? He will come in a time of prosperity. Now, there's a gentleman called John Carroll Williams, who happens to be the chief executive officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. He knows a little bit about bankruptcy, because California, like Detroit, is basically bankrupt. Okay, he knows a bit about it. At the beginning of this year, he wrote this. Now, he's no fly on the wall, this guy. He's inside the institutions that know. He thinks hyperinflation would be a problem. Well, hasn't happened yet. Might not happen, who knows? But he says this, the end game begins. There is a 90% chance, he said, of hyperinflationary Great Depression beginning in 2014. Well, it might not have to be caused by hyperinflation. It might be caused by other factors, because in the state that this man comes from, California, they're experiencing their third year of drought. Now, here you've got a satellite picture on the January the 13th, 2013, of the Rocky Mountains. It wasn't a terribly big snowfall that year. But then you've got a picture in 2014. It's pretty miserable, isn't it? That's why when you go, as I do, through California from top to bottom, and you pass by a lot of lakes and dams where they, you know, dam up the water for farming, etc., this is what you find. This is just one near San Jose. I passed the Mount Shasta Dam recently. It's got about 10% in it. It's a principal dam in Northern California. They are in serious trouble, which is why when you drive through the agricultural areas of California, you see a lot of trees that weren't pruned last year. You see a lot of vacant paddocks that were not ploughed and planted. Why? Well, there's no water. Now, California used to be the fourth largest economy in the world in its own right. That could be a trigger, couldn't it? What about Europe? Well, the European Central Bank in June this year, through a strong euro, the threat of deflation, ballooning debt levels and slow growth, it forced the ECB, this gentleman here, Mario Draghi, is the head of that European Central Bank, to slash interest rates, and they now have negative interest rates in Europe. Hands up anyone here would like to leave their money in a bank that charges you for the privilege of having it there. Well, that's what it's like in Europe. All right? They charge you. They don't give you any interest. It's negative interest they charge you for having your money in the bank. Now, how long do you think that's going to last? Well, they don't think it's going to last very long themselves, because you see, when they made that decision, they also made another one. They made a decision to use the American quantitative easing process, which lasts about 2 or 3 years, and then the bottom falls out of your currency. So that's their desperate measures. Just another one of the many possible triggers for a collapse of the financial system that many pundits, of course, know is near. The end game has begun for Europe. And they are comparing history with the current situation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average stock market activity from 1928 to 29 is what you can see there in the black. That's the 1928-29 leading up to the crash on the 18th of November. The red one, of course, is the current process. Someone noticed, and it's never happened in the last 70 or 80 years, someone noticed that it's almost identical. It's following exactly the same pattern. All right? Yeah. And in fact, in the last month, it's again identical. Massive rises, then collapses, and massive rises. That's happening right now. So who knows? Who knows how close we might be? But we can't be very far away. And this is what happens when you have depressions. In 1929 through 30, a worldwide depression, it lasts for 10 years, and you can only get out of it by a war, because you can close, as they did in the Second World War, 60 million mouths. You don't have to feed those people. And, of course, you put people back to work in factories, manufacturing tanks and weapons and planes and all sorts. You have to have a war to get out of depressions. You know, you don't want to last 25 years, then go to war. And that's what the nations will do. Because you see, when this depression occurs, and it will come 10 years later, because the dead, we believe, will be raised before it happens, the dead will be raised 10 years later, there will be a war, but this will be the one to end all wars. It'll be the Armageddon of the Bible. Now, someone might say to me, but you know, it's possible, Brother Jim, it's possible that we could go through a 25-year depression and come out the other end and get back to prosperity, and then Christ will come if what you're saying is correct. It's possible. It's not possible. You know why? Because the papal system has to be destroyed in the year 2060. That's why. And that's only 46 years away. And we know that the divine judgments, beginning with Armageddon, will last 40 years. So it's impossible. This is the last cycle of human prosperity. I don't want to move on a minute. I want to talk about this year, 2060. So what will happen, brothers and sisters and young people and friends, is this: that we will be taken to judgment before the crash occurs. We will be at the judgment seat while all of this chaos is going on. And if you carefully read Daniel chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, you will notice a repeated phrase. It's the phrase, "and at that time." "And at that time shall Michael stand up, that great prince which stands for the children of thy people. And at that time there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation upon the earth. And many that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake." It's the time of the resurrection. The resurrection is concomitant with the beginning of the time of trouble such as never was. And that's why Christ says in Luke 21 verse 26, he says, "Men's hearts failing them for fear." Well, you could say that that's happening today. Well, yes, in some measure it is. There are people fearful Yes, true. He doesn't mean now. He means when the time of trouble begins. And the proof of that lies in the context of Luke 21, because in the next passage, it tells you that they then see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven, the clouds of glory. In other words, he's got his saints with him. He's already collected them when they see him coming. So you see, that is about that time of trouble. Well, it's happening, and it is going to happen very soon. Now, I want to move on to this matter then of 2060, just to explain why there can't be another cycle of collapse and then getting back to prosperity before it all comes to an end. Christ and the saints will destroy the revived Holy Roman Empire. And, of course, that's exactly what the European Union is about. It's about reviving that empire. That's why they have the head of Charlemagne on the back of their coins. That's why, even though he reigned from 769 AD when his father died, they have the dates 800 to 814. Well, 800 was the time that he became the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Christmas Day of 800 AD. And he died in 814. So they're trying to rebuild the Holy Roman Empire, which, of course, is what this book was about, the principality and power of Europe, Britain, and the emerging Holy Roman Empire. When does it come to an end? Well, here is a chart of the pattern of Roman Catholic resistance to Christ, and those of you who are with us on Saturday will have seen this chart several times already. This is the pattern of Roman Catholic resistance to Christ's rule for 40 years after Armageddon. Now, Christ will have come, of course, 10 years prior to his appearance at Armageddon, when the Mount of Olives splits and the great earthquake destroys the infrastructure of the world. He will have come to collect his saints and to prepare them for their role in that. But then you've got this pattern set out in the scriptures of a huge blow to Catholic power, but not a fatal blow by any means, because they will revive their power and resist the rule of Christ. And 10 years later, Revelation 14 verse 8 tells us that Rome as a city is destroyed. And then you've got what's called the hour of judgment, the following 30 years, at which time Elijah will have all of the Jews from all countries of the earth who will be collected after the events of Armageddon, even though they will be warned prior to it. They will be collected after because there'll be nothing to stay for. And he will finally have them in what's called the wilderness of the peoples, and they will be the weapon against Babylon the Great, the system that will resist the rule of our Lord Jesus Christ. So when will the Pope and this empire that supports him be destroyed? The HRE there, by the way, is the Holy Roman Empire. You know, it's quite a long phrase, so that's the abbreviation of it. The Holy Roman Empire and papal dominion must end by 2060. And I'm going to take you back in a minute to Daniel chapter 7, and we're going to have a look at that prophecy. But let me just point out one thing before I do. Sir Isaac Newton knew that date. Now, you know Sir Isaac Newton. He was very famous, of course. He lived from 1642 to 1727. He was a very well-known and famous mathematician and physicist, one of the foremost scientific minds of his time, of course. Well, he wrote on religion as well. He wrote on Bible prophecy, on the book of Daniel, for example. He rejected the Trinity as unscriptural and predicted 2060 as the year of the demise of the papacy. In fact, there's a note in the margin of his Bible, and a brother, Brother Stephen Snowbelin, who lectures in the University of Halifax, Nova Scotia, has actually seen that note in his Bible, because he's an expert on Sir Isaac Newton and lectures on it. He's seen the actual note written by Sir Isaac Newton in 1750. Think about that. That's ancient history, isn't it? Now, how did he know that? All right? How could you possibly know that? Well, I had to keep his private papers quiet because, of course, he would have been kicked out of his job. The church would have been hunting for him if they'd seen the note in the margin of his Bible and his private papers. So how could anyone living nearly 300 years ago predict the demise of the largest Christian organisation on earth in 2060? Well, because he read his Bible properly. That's why. He didn't allow himself to be governed by what he saw. He didn't see anything. He just interpreted the Bible correctly. And that's the best way to interpret Bible prophecy. Not from what you see, but from what it says. And I want to take you now to Daniel chapter 7 and see what it says about this matter of 2060. Now, I haven't got time, of course, to work you all through every verse of Daniel chapter 7. Those of you who are familiar with it will know that in the first seven verses it sets out the emergence of four beasts that rise up out of the sea, which are equivalent to the four metals of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Of Daniel chapter 2, you will be familiar with that. I'm going to focus on verse 8 of Daniel chapter 7. Now, verse 7, of course, at the end of that verse, tells us that this fourth beast, which is clearly the Roman Empire, had 10 horns. Now, the reason for those 10 horns, of course, is that the Roman Empire was broken up by barbarian invasions, and there were at least 10 of them who formed kingdoms on the territory, the body of the Roman Empire. That's why it's got 10 horns. But then history went on, of course, didn't it? And that's what verse 8 is about, because verse 8 says, I considered the horns. So he's looking at that period of history when the Roman Empire has been dissolved by these barbarian invasions who have set up their little empires or kingdoms on it. He goes on to say, and behold, there came up another among them, another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns, that is three of the 10, plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now, the good thing about this is you don't actually have to put an interpretation on it, because you're given the interpretation in Daniel chapter 7. If you cast your eyes over to verses 23 onwards, it gives you the interpretation. All right, it's telling you what happened here. Now, what happened, of course, was that this was the beginnings of the Holy Roman Empire. And this little horn that comes up in the place of three has some interesting features. It's got eyes like the eyes of a man. Now, of course, the papacy does happen to call itself the Holy See, not S-E-A, but S-E-E. Why? Because he's got his priests all over the world. He knows everything that's going on. All right? They report to him. So it's the Holy See. But moreover, he has a mouth like a man. And the Pope, of course, issues encyclicals. Encyclicals are supposedly, that they can't be questioned. They're infallible when the Pope speaks ex cathedra. The only problem with that, of course, is that there's quite a few encyclicals that contradict each other, which does sort of undermine the infallibility question. However, the Pope issues encyclicals, changing laws and times and seasons. We work on the Gregorian calendar, don't we? Yeah. Well, who invented that? Pope Gregory the 13th. So you see, he can issue these decrees. You will work by this calendar. Oh, yes, sir. Three bags full, sir. And the world follows him. So that is why it has this mouth that speaks great things. Changes times and seasons, as we're told in Daniel chapter 7. Well, this is what happened in history. Towards the end of the 7th century, the papacy fell out with its sponsors in the east. You see, the Western Empire had been dissolved by barbarian invasions. But the Eastern Roman Empire continued. In fact, it lasted for 1,000 years. It continued on in the east, in Constantinople. So the Pope was shepherded, guided, and protected by the Eastern Roman emperors, and they issued decrees, as you're going to see in a minute, for the protection and for the promotion of the papacy as a power in the West. Well, the Pope fell out with the Eastern emperors towards the end of the 7th century over matters of idolatry. The Eastern emperors decided that they were going to give away idols. They're going to take all their idols out of their churches. And they wrote to the Pope and said, we're getting rid of our idols. We want you to get rid of yours. He said, go jump in the lake. So they replied, well, you can row your own canoe in the lake then. You're on your own. We're not going to give you any more military support or financial support. You're on your own. Oh, okay. Well, the three Lombard kingdoms in northern Italy, kingdoms that had been formed by barbarian invasions, decided, well, this is an ideal opportunity to give the Pope some pepper. So they did. And they made his life unbearable until he had to call upon the King of France, humiliatingly called upon the King of France, who of course was a good Catholic, to save him from the Lombards. So, who was this King of France? Well, it was Pepin. Pepin the Short, he was called. Pepin, King of France. And he came down in 754, and in a series of campaigns, he destroyed the armies of these three Lombard kingdoms and gave their territories to the Pope. He said, "Thank you very much." And he immediately created the Triple Tiara Crown, which the Pope wears to this day. See this Triple Tiara Crown? It looks a bit like a horn. It's a pretty fat horn, to be sure, but it actually has three parts to it. Why? Well, three horns were plucked up for the formation of the Holy Roman Empire. But that wasn't when the Holy Roman Empire came into existence, because it had special characteristics, as we know from Revelation 13. There had to be an emperor horn and a papal horn on the beast of the earth. It wasn't until 800 AD that came to pass, when Charlemagne, who'd been king for a long time in France, in the stead of his father — he bumped off his brothers to become king, which is what they normally do. In 800 AD, he came down to Rome, and Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and of course it lasted for 1,000 years, like the Eastern Empire had done. And he became the protector of the church, the political power, the military power of this new organisation, the Holy Roman Empire, which the European nations are trying to rebuild. Okay, so that is the history. 800 AD, Christmas Day, is the anniversary, the date of the founding of the Holy Roman Empire. So there's the interpretation. You go to Daniel chapter 7, verses 23 to 26, you have the interpretation. Now, I don't need to read that. I don't need to read all of that, do I? Because you see, at the end of this verse it says, "And he shall subdue three kings, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws," which he has done, "and they shall be given into his hand until, it's going to terminate, a time and times and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end." It talks about the kingdom being given to the people of the saints. We won't go into all the details of that. That's not what we're here for. We're here to talk about the timing. So what is the timing? Well, you see, when the Jews came back from Babylon, they brought back the Babylonian calendar with them, and God used it in the period of Daniel's prophecy, because, of course, that was their calendar at the time. 360 days in a year. That's why the Jews have to have a 7th month to catch up with everybody else. Every few years, a 13th month. Every 6 or 7 years, they have a 13th month to catch up with everybody else. Otherwise, their seasons would be out of kilter. Well, in Daniel chapter 7, verse 25, we've got this time, times, and a dividing of time. A time to a Jew in those days was 360 days a year, 360 days. So you've got a time. Well, times is two 360s, isn't it? So we've got 360 plus 720, and a dividing of time. Let's divide it down the middle, which is logical. So you've got 180. You add 360 and 720 and 180, you get 1260. And we know that the Bible uses the day for a year principle extensively. All right, there's no question about that. So we've got here a period of 1260 years. Now, does this work? Well, let's just stay inside the Gregorian calendar. It works if you stay inside it. AD 312 was the triumph of Constantine, the man-child of sin, of 2 Thessalonians 2. That's when the persecution of the true believers began in earnest. They were chased all over, and Constantine gave the apostate Christian church the right and the power to chase them and destroy them. How long did that last? How long did they witness against the system? Well, until 1572, 1260 years later, when effective witnessing against the system came to an end. Or, to be sure, the death of the witnesses didn't occur until 1685, but effective witnessing was gone through the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day in France in 1572. Now, I talked about the Eastern emperors giving power to the Pope in the West. One of them was Justinian. He issued his Justinian Decretals, giving the Bishop of Rome, who became the Pope in due course, headship of the church, that is, he gave him political power. So you add your 1260 to 529 to 533, which was the period in which these decrees were issued, and what do you get? 1789 to 1793. Now, all of you will know that that's the French Revolution. It reached its height at the end of 1793. In 1794, things began to subside when they cut off Robespierre's head. Okay, so the effective period of the overthrow of Catholicism in France was in that period, 1789 to 1793. There was another little emperor. He was a little emperor. He was a former centurion, a grubby little man called Phocas, who could only get into power because God put him there. Well, he issued decrees in 608, 610, and granted the papacy what's called temporal, that's real political power, where you've got power over people and land. Okay, so he gave him this temporal power in the West. Well, add your 1260 to 608, 610, and you come to 1868 to 1870. What happened then? Well, Garibaldi came up from Naples. He drove the Pope out of Rome, so he lost his control over land and people. He went into exile, and in 1870, his response was to call the First Vatican Council and to declare himself infallible when speaking ex cathedra. That was his response. He lost his power. Yes, yeah, Il Duce Mussolini gave the Pope 100 acres in Rome. In 1929, so yes, he's now got some temporal power back. He's got his own little state of 100 acres in Rome, which is a separate nation to Italy. And of course, he's growing in power every day. So let's have a look at what we are learning here about these times. We know that the 1260 works in history. In fact, I challenge anyone to go back through history and find me one time, just one will do, when the Pope acquires any kind of power that doesn't terminate in 1260. You know what? You're not going to find one. They all terminate in 1260 years. Every single one of them. That's telling you something. The last one's not going to fail. It will not fail. So let's review the times. The Holy Roman Empire had two important dates at its inception. There was 758 AD when Pepin, King of France, conquered the three barbarian states in Italy and gave them to the Pope. There was 800 AD when Pope Leo crowned Charlemagne Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So add 1260 to these two dates. What do you get? Well, let's take the 758 first. 758 plus 1260. Now, you always get the reverse at the end of 1260. If you get power, you lose it 1260 later. If you humiliate it at the beginning, you get power and honour 1260 later. You always get the reverse. So what happened in 758? Well, he got humiliated. He had to call on Pepin to save him. Oh, yeah, he got the three states, but it was really a humiliation. Think about the reverse. I believe that in 2018, the papacy will likely regain immense power, political power in Europe. And you know how we'll get that? Because when this depression comes, Europe is going to go down the gurgler big time. And the northern European nations are going to say bye-bye to the southern bankrupt countries like Italy, France, Portugal, Greece, all those, that mob. They're going to say bye-bye. You're on your own. And guess where those nations will be? And there'll be 10 of them, because there are 10 kings on the toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image, supporting the papacy, all right, part of the Confederacy of Gog. Guess where their boundary is? Well, it just happens to be the Rhine and the Danube. And guess where the boundary of the old Roman Empire was? The Rhine and the Danube. Yeah. 2018. So I think that the Depression will come before then, because that's what's going to force that change. You know what people do when they go into real poverty, like the Russians did in the mid-90s? What do? They go back to religion. That's what they do. And so will the Europeans. Well, let's take the other date. 800 plus 1260 is 2006. This is why Sir Isaac Newton could write that in the margin of his Bible, Demise of the Pope, 2060. Simple. I mean, he was a mathematician. You don't need to be Sir Isaac Newton to work that out, do you? If 800 is the last time that the Pope gets any kind of real power, add 1260. A child can do that. It will come to pass. All right. That's the year of the destruction of the Holy Roman Empire, which supports the papacy, and the Pope himself will end. But not all Catholics, and I want you to now listen very carefully. You see, I want to talk about what's going to happen at the end of this period. We showed this chart on Saturday, and I'll make a mention of it a bit more in a moment. It starts here with the resurrection of the dead 50 years later, and you can prove the 50 years from Ezekiel. You just need to read chapter 2 of Brother Sully's book, The Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy. All the information's there. You can prove that. It's a 50-year period from the resurrection of the dead to the time that Christ has his universal rule and walks his bride around the house. So where does the Pope come in here? Well, this 30 years of judgment brought about by the second exodus of Israel plunging through Europe, here he goes down the Gerber, sometime towards the end. But that's not the end of all of his supporters. I want to show you that. Revelation 19. Can you join me in Revelation 19, please? In Revelation 19, we have a prophecy about Christ and the saints going out against Babylon the Great, sweeping that power away. And we read this in verse 20 of Revelation 19. And the beast was taken. Now that beast, you can have to accept this, Brother Thomas correctly says that that beast is the revived Holy Roman Empire. So the revived Holy Roman Empire was taken, and with him the false prophet, that's the Pope, that wrought signs before him, and they're cast into a lake of fire at the end of verse 20. But that's not the end of it, is it? That is not the end of it. Because then you read this in verse 21. It says, and the remnant was slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceeds out of his mouth. And all the fowls, that is the nations who have submitted to Christ, were filled with their flesh. So you see, yes, the papacy must go down the gurgler in 2060, but that doesn't mean the end of all Catholics and those who supported that system against Christ. There's a clean-up period required. So how long is that clean-up period? Well, the length of that period, in fact, tells us how long we have got to go. Now, I don't know what the length of the period is. We're not told. So I'm not going to stab in the dark. I don't know. But I want to show you how this works. So here you've got your resurrection of the dead, and 50 years later, Christ walking his bride around the house. Now, he won't do that, of course, until one, the house is complete, and two, until he's exposed the Catholic harlot for what she is. She claims to be the bride of Christ. And when he's exposed her, then he can reveal his bride, his true bride, to the world. So her glory will be held in until that happens. Oh yes, they'll be out there working, but they won't be seen in all their glory. Now the only fixed date we have here is this date, 2060. So here is the program. We've got 50 years, and we know, as we saw on Saturday, we know that you can determine that the actual judgments from Armageddon to this period here when Christ walked his bride around the house is 40 years. So you've got 10 years up front, okay? That's the framework. And you can demonstrate that pretty simply from the Word of God. So then, we've just seen in Revelation 19:21 that there's a clean-up period for the remnant right here at the end. And the length of that period will determine how long we have. So, if Christ comes in 2014, and that's a real possibility, that period will be 4 years. Now, just let your mind settle on that for a while. This is the only fixed date, this one, 2060. This is the framework that sits over it. If it's a 50-year period, and it is, and Christ walks his bride around the house 50 years after the resurrection, but he comes in 2014, when does he walk his bride around the house? Well, you add 50 years to 2014, don't you? And you get 2064. But if the Pope's destroyed in 2060, and he walks his bride around the house in 2064, then the clean-up period is 4 years. Got it? But what if he comes in 2015? Well, you've got to shift it, don't you? You've got to shift it a bit further. So this is 5 years then. Well, what if he comes in 2016? Well, it's 6 years. What if he comes in 2017? Well, it's 7 years. Well, who knows how long God's going to hold the strings of the coming depression. You know, When is the puff of wind from the angels going to blow the house of cards over? I don't know. But I wouldn't have thought you needed too much time for a clean-up. But it's at least 4 years right now. Let me just show you this another way. Now, if you watch this framework, you see this framework here. You watch it when I press the button, see what happens. The only fixed date that we have is this one here, okay? Now, watch the framework. It can shift that way. Should we try that again? Yeah, I like this. It's good. So, hang on. Yeah, here we go. See, the framework shifts. Now, the reason I've done this, brothers and sisters and friends, is this. I have been accused by people saying that Christ came in 2010 using this. All right? That's ridiculous. I've also been accused by people, you're trying to determine a date of the return of Christ. I have never done that, and I never will. But you'll hear me thumping the lectern that he's near at hand, okay? I can't tell you the day, the hour, or the year. I don't know. But I know he's at hand. All right? Our job as watchmen is to sound the trumpet from the wall. People don't take any notice. Their blood's on their head. They take notice, they'll be in the kingdom. That's the principle involved here. So if I hear of any, you know, news coming back that this idiot from Australia is nominating a year for the return of Christ, I'll be on your doorstep next time I'm in this country. All right? I don't want any of that nonsense. Well, let's move on from that. Daniel chapter 2, we're familiar with it. But, you know, it's not as well understood as it might be. You know, other religions will hold lectures, public lectures on Daniel 2 and point out there are four world empires, but they don't emphasise the most important part of it. The most important part of it is actually about the latter days. It's a prophecy about the latter days. That's what Daniel 2 verse 28 says. Now, we're familiar with the image and what it represents, the four world empires, and we come down here to modern Europe. We know that in this era of time, the stone strikes the feet and over goes the image, and it's ground to powder. Yes, together. The whole image, ground to powder, together. This is the message of verse 35. It's the message of verse 28. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together. You can't break them to pieces together unless they are there together, all at the same time. So the image has to stand up complete in the land. And that's the great drama, isn't it, of Daniel chapter 2, is that the image is formed of the four world empires. And each of those four had the territory of Israel in it. And until Gog is victorious in the land of Israel, the image can't stand up. It has to have that territory in it. And so you see, what happens is that the time that Gog is victorious and they think they've won the day, that's when the image stands up in all its terrifying form. And it's only up for seconds or minutes. And the stone grinds it for the next 40 years. That's the great drama of Daniel 2. That's not understood by the churches outside, because that's about Armageddon. Right, and that's near at hand. But I want to focus on the feet, because when Brother Thomas wrote the exposition of Daniel, he said the feet hadn't been formed, and they hadn't been formed even until very recently. We are actually watching the feet being formed right now. I want to show you that. But before I do, there's one little issue I want to address, and that's the issue of Britain. You know, I once heard a lecture, someone got up and said, well, because Britain was a part of the Roman Empire, Britain is part of Nebuchadnezzar's image and therefore will be coming down against Israel. I heard that. Well, how? That's just rubbish. Why is it rubbish? Well, I want to show you. If it's wrong, you can prove it wrong. Between 395 and 420 AD, the Roman Empire was finally resolved into two legs. There'd been all sorts of divisions of the empire, all sorts of divisions of the empire in its history. But it wasn't until this period that it was resolved into two legs, with one emperor in Rome and another in Constantinople. Rome left Britain between 383 and 410 AD. So when the legs were actually formed, Britain was no longer part of the Roman Empire. Now, this is how the history happened. Theodosius died in AD 395. His sons Honorius, who was aged 12, became emperor of the West, and his brother Arcadius was 17, became emperor of the East. Neither of them were very competent, and both of them were quite evil. You know, so as a 12-year-old and a 17-year-old, they probably didn't know too much about, you know, fighting to gain ascendancy. Well, it took some time. But eventually, by 410, when Alaric came and did his work in Rome, by about 410 through to 420, these two powers became quite distinct. That's why it says here, this division of the empire into eastern and western parts was the decisive one, which sent the two on separate ways. One of the two emperors had always enjoyed seniority over the other. Not so now. However, the accession of Arcadius and Honorius is widely seen as the division of the Roman Empire into two completely separate parts. By 410, the separation was almost complete. Now, why is that important? Well, because you see, when the two legs were formed, Britain wasn't part of the empire. You see this end of Roman rule up here? It's pretty hard to read from the back, I would guess, but actually gives you a list over here. 383, final departure from the west and the north. 401, departing from Hadrian's Wall. 407, final departure of the southeast. 409, expulsion of the Roman magistrates from cities. And then Honorius issued a decree in 410 saying, we're out, we're gone, finished. So you see, Britain wasn't part of the Roman Empire at the formation of the two iron legs. Britain is clearly the Tarshish of Ezekiel 38, verse 13, and Britain with its young lions will oppose Gog's invasion of the land. And the historical young lions, brethren and sisters, are Australia, Canada, India, and New Zealand. Now, usually at this point I duck down again because, you know, rotten tomatoes start being thrown at me, because America is not actually a young lion. That's a furphy. America is not a young lion. America is going to be KO'd by the depression that's coming, and they will go through the same cycle they did prior to the Second World War. No interest whatever in anybody else's affairs. Don't want to get involved in a European war, especially not a Middle East war. Too concerned about trying to rebuild their own ranks. You know, Brother Thomas said something about this. But just a review of what happens here. Britain is now part of the EU, of course, isn't it? Both Conservative and Labour parties strongly supported being part of the European Union since 1973, actually, it should be, although it began in 68. However, Britain has strenuously refused to use the euro and retain the pound as its currency. David Cameron, the current Conservative Prime Minister, is a strong supporter of remaining within Europe, but his people don't agree with him. He's got a big problem because public opinion has turned immensely against staying within Europe. So how has this happened? Now, probably time for a bit of light relief, I guess. I'm going to just show another couple of minutes of video. This is going to be a video of Nigel Farage. Now, some of you will have heard of Nigel Farage. He is a gentleman who has been a member of the European Parliament since 1999, and he's given them heaps. He's given them a lot of trouble over that period. He's been there for 15 years. And he makes life unbearable. They tried to assassinate him once. He's that bad, in their view. So here he is, speaking on behalf of a combined group called UKIP, that's the UK Independence Party, and the EFD group, the European whatever they call themselves. They want to be out of Europe too.
Das Wort hat jetzt für die EFD-Fraktion, Herr...
On behalf of the EFD, Mr. Farage.
Well, Mr. Van Rompuy, when you first appeared here in what proved to be a rather expensive speech, I said you'd be the quiet assassin of nation-state democracy. And sure enough, in your dull and technocratic way, you've gone about your course, but I have to say, you're even worse than I thought you were going to be. I thought it was just going to be a federal Europe, a federal union. But actually it appears, with every statement you make, that what you now want is the total subjugation of the states to completely undemocratic structures based in Brussels. I misread the bailouts. I thought that when the bailouts happened, and I could see the panic around this chamber, people fearing economic meltdown, but you, of course, were calm through it all, because you saw the bailouts as your opportunity to take control. Just think how Ireland today is managed. Greece, for that matter. The sinister-sounding troika come in, 50 officials, spend a few days in the country, investigate the situation, and then tell puppet prime ministers what they may or may not do. And I note great enthusiasm in this chamber for Spain to have a bailout. Lots of members here want Spain to accept the bailout so that they too are subjugated to this new order. Indeed, in Italy, the appointee there, Mr. Monti, is very keen for his own country to be bailed out because, to quote him, he fears that parliamentary democracy could bring down the European Union. So I think it's pretty clear that your next phase is for those that haven't been bailed out and may not need to be bailed out. You now want them to sign guarantees, budget guarantees, and to have the power to strike down national budgets after they have been through parliaments. I have to say, I feel that the Eurozone is now in a very dark place, economically, socially, politically, and I fear that the countries trapped inside it, in that prison, will be there for many years to come. So it's odd against this backdrop that the Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the European Union. It's true that Germany hasn't invaded France since 1945, but I don't think there was any prospect of that happening, unless, of course, what you're all saying is that the Germans are inherently bad people. No, the threat actually came from Russia, and we should be thanking NATO, and we should be thanking millions of American soldiers who served on European soil to maintain peace. Yet I don't hear a word of that because we loathe America and everything that it stands for. No, this is now a divided, split Europe, with neo-Nazi politics on the rise, with violent demonstrations in the streets, and I frankly think that the award of that Nobel Prize devalues that whole organisation. Well, it's not all bad news, because in Britain, the opinion polls are clear that a clear, settled majority of Brits now want to leave this union, leaving David Cameron as piggy in the middle, trying to pretend to be a Eurosceptic when he comes over here, going back home and claiming victories, but he's stuck. And I predict one thing, big political change is coming in Britain because he's losing the support of millions of his own voters. Thank you.
That's true. And a referendum will be held by at least 2017, and Cameron knows he's going to lose it. Britain will come out of the European Union. And that will be another fulfilment of Bible prophecy. Now, I'm going to run out of time tonight. I can see that. I've shown far too many videos, obviously. So I'll do my best to get through a bit more, and then I'll let you go and have some refreshments out the back. Just a brief word about Britain, the Tarshish of Ezekiel 38 and its young lions. This is the First World War poster that sets out who they are. He's the old lion, helped by the young lions. They are Australia, Canada, India and New Zealand. It's no accident that those countries came through the global financial crisis of 2008 better than most others. There's reasons for that. So another brief word about Brother Thomas's understanding of America's role in Bible prophecy. In the many references made to the young lions in his writings, he never mentions America in that context. Now, a sister wrote to him in 1860 asking where America fits into Bible prophecy. And so he replied in a rather lengthy article, pages 107 and 108 of that particular magazine, under the heading The Destiny of the United States, he wrote these words. By America in the inquiry, we presume, is meant the United States. In reply, we remark that this confederacy is not represented by any prophetic symbols, nor are there any verbal predictions concerning it, after the manner of those concerning Babylon, Persia, Macedonia, Rome, the Ten Kingdoms, Russia, and so forth. And he would include, of course, Britain in that, because he believed Tarshish was Britain. So that was his view. Where this idea of America being a young lion came from, I don't know, but I don't care. It's not right. The Bible doesn't speak anything about America as a young lion. Now, a final word about this gentleman, Pope Francis I. He was awarded, of course, the Time Person of the Year in 2013. You don't get that award for virtue because he only just beat these two gentlemen, if you could call them that. Bashar Assad, who's killed 200,000 of his own people and put 4 million of them into refugee status. And the other guy, of course, was Edward Snowden. He's famous in this country. So he beat those two because it's all about influence in the world. And he does have influence. So I want to just talk briefly about Pope Francis I and modernism. He presents himself as a grandfatherly, liberal-minded, caring figure and a man of the people. He's actually a Jesuit. He's the first Jesuit to be made Pope in history. Jesuits are the stormtroopers of the Roman Catholic Church. They're the ones in the front line. You know, the Pope never got his hands dirty. He sent the Jesuits to kill people off in the Inquisition and things like that. Well, that's why they never elected a Jesuit to be Pope, but he's one. Jesuits sign it with their own blood that they'll never change church doctrine and customs. So why is this guy talking as though he is going to change church doctrines and customs? He's recently given hope to homosexuals that they have a place in the church. He started off a campaign to raise questions about pastoral care for same-sex couples and remarried divorcees that the church has, of course, traditionally ignored. Well, this is what Time said about him. John Paul II and Benedict XVI were professors of theology. Francis is a former janitor, nightclub bouncer, chemical technician and literature teacher, which is not a bad CV. And behind his self-effacing facade, he is a very canny operator. No question about that. He makes masterly use of 21st century tools to perform what they call his first century office, which of course is nonsense. But what makes this Pope so important is the speed with which he has captured the imagination of millions who had given up on hoping for the church at all. He's quoted saying of women who consider abortion because of poverty or rape, who can remain unmoved before such painful situations? He's not talking about changing the laws of the church. Of gay people, if a homosexual person is of goodwill and is in search of God, I am no one to judge. He's not changing the law about that. To divorced and remarried Catholics who are by rule forbidden from taking communion, he says that this is a crucial right. It's not a prize for the perfect, but a powerful medicine and nourishment for the weak. Why is he saying these sorts of things? Well, because Bible prophecy has to be fulfilled. That's why. God puts the right people in the right place at the right time. You want to form the feet, they've got to be formed of iron and clay. What's the iron? All that remains of the Roman Empire of old. What's that? It's religion. Roman Catholicism. Now, Daniel chapter 2, 41 and 43 say this. Whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay, part of iron. There shall be in it of the strength of the iron, Roman Catholicism, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. Now, I want you to notice something. Historically, it was the clay, the barbarian peoples, the common peoples, who came down and they mingled themselves with the iron of the Roman Empire, didn't they? That's not what this is about. This is the other way around. This is not about clay mingling itself with iron. This is about iron mingling itself with clay. Read the next verse, verse 43. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they, the iron, shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, the clay. But they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of that word mixed. It's this word garab. It means to commingle, can mean to be a guarantor. That's beside the point. Point I want to make is this, brothers and sisters and young people and friends. Pope Francis I is deliberately setting out in a campaign to mingle iron with clay. And when this depression comes, he's going to have a really powerful wind behind him to achieve that. If he's still there, his successor will probably do the same. They're going to mix two things that don't hold together. You cannot hold these two together for very long, especially if you hit them on the feet with a stone. But they will hold together long enough for the image to stand up in the land. It's got to have feet to stand up. That's what's happening right now. Was this ever understood in Christadelphia? If you've read Brother Sully's book, The Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy, to which I would recommend you, he says in the second chapter of Daniel, he describes the image. I'm not going to read all that. I'm going to read this coloured part. The fourth element of the image in its latter-day phase assumes the aspect of clay and iron mixed. That is, republicanism, that's democracy, clay, common people, and autocracy, that's dictatorship, that's iron, shown perhaps in one of its most subtle aspects in the silent capture of democracy by autocratic ecclesiasticism, iron, enabling the latter, autocratic ecclesiasticism to ride into power thereby. There's a man who interpreted Bible prophecy not from what he saw, but from what he read. And that's what we should be doing. And when you see it come to pass, as we are seeing it come to pass, rejoice. Rejoice because the day is at hand.